This is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs of Atidin Web Yeshiva with the final session of this semester's meetings of the Jews, Judaism, and Modernity Jewish History series, which we'll be continuing in a few months during the fall semester of Web Yeshiva. So tune back to catch up with us when we continue. Okay, good evening, everyone. If you have a video camera, hit the send video button on your camera, and we will get started. This is, of course, our last session of the course for this Zman, for this semester. Web Yeshiva, of course, will be going on break after Tisha B'Av until Elul. During Elul, we always have, in the month of the Chagim, of the High Holidays, we have a special series of shiurim about things related to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, etc. And then we will be continuing with our journey through Jewish history later in the year. Let me just turn on the recorder here. We never, of course, cover as much ground as we hope. When we started, we were someplace in the mid-17th century, and now we're ensconced in the 19th century. I wanted to, we've kind of concluded a unit, as it were, discussing the advent of Reform Judaism, or the emancipation, the advent of Reform Judaism as a condition of the emancipation, or as a result of the emancipation, I should say, the response to Reform Judaism, as particularly as championed by the thought of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. We spent a number of sessions discussing that. And now, according to kind of like the way one would normally organize a course about Jewish history, we would probably turn our attention to the East. We've been focused a little bit in Western Europe, in France, in Germany, and we've been neglecting our friends in the East. No offense, Joel, but we would be naturally curious about how things have been evolving over there, because Eastern Europe is a little slower to come into the modern world, not only Eastern European Jewry, but Eastern Europe altogether. And the way that emancipation in Russia, the way that the Enlightenment in Eastern Europe, the way that the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, the way that Reform, all of these things play out in Eastern Europe is really much different than in Western Europe. The way that anti-Semitism rears its ugly head in Eastern Europe is different than it is in Western Europe. And it will be interesting to look to the East to see how those things play out. It's probably particularly interesting for many of us because that, of course, is where many of us hail from. At least part of our DNA comes from the Pale of Jewish Settlement. I assume that I'm speaking for many of us when I say that. I know that's true for me. And looking at your last names, I'm guessing that it's true for many of you as well, at least for part of your family. But since we have only one session left this semester, and we'll be delayed a little bit in continuing, we'll pick up again after the Chagim, I thought to spend tonight talking a bit about just some kind of reflections on the study of Jewish history. If you are curious, you can check the archives for the very first session where we started talking about the meaning and purpose of study of Jewish history. And I thought that it would be in place to do a little bit of that tonight to see how it relates to what it is we've studied until now, and then to look forward to continuing our journey up till, let's say, the present day, when we continue in a few months' time. The ingrained into our identity is this notion of, you know, the biblical notion even of Zechor Yemot Olam Binu Shnot Dor Vador, that we're encouraged to, where it's imperative for us to remember history, remember the days of the world, to understand the years of the generations, that studying history, that knowing history is connected both to Zechira and to, oops, Shlomi, could you stop making that noise, please? Excuse me. This idea of Zechira and Bina, that it's not enough merely to remember something, but it's necessary also to understand it. Sha'al avicha v'yagedcha, zekenecha v'yomru lach. And that the study of history, again, the pasuk is not talking about, it would be anachronistic to talk about the study of history in this pasuk, but insofar as Moshe Rabbeinu is telling us that there's value, there's benefit to looking to the past, that past is very much hooked up with our parents, our elders, past generations, that the transmission of history is connected very much to people, towards the chain of transmission. I'll come back to that in a second. The Torah reminds us, coming up, we'll be reading it next week. Hishamer lecha pen tishkach et Hashem Elokecha levilti shmor mitzvotav v'mishpatav v'chuktav sher enochi mitzvcha hayom v'ram levavecha v'shachachta et Hashem Elokecha, that out of haughtiness, God forbid, you'll come to forget God who's brought you out of the land of Israel. V'haya im shachoach tishkach, if, God forbid, you would forget God, v'halachta acharei elohim acherim v'avaratem v'yishtachavita lahem, if you should forget God and serve other idols and do avodah zarah, well then there'll be an account to pay for that. The entire notion of memory, of biblical memory, is caught up with the imperative not to forget. It's never enough almost to remember something. We're doubly enjoined to also not forget it. I mean, the most clear examples of that, of course, the what jumps off the page, what jumps to your memory in that context, the double meaning of remembering, but also the prohibition against forgetting. What do you recall in that context? Shabbat? Okay. It's not so much as... Amalek, yeah, Amalek. It's not enough to remember what Amalek does to us. We're forbidden to ever forget it. In this monograph here, last time we talked about some notable books in Jewish history. Perhaps one of the most notable books in Jewish history to come out, I think the first edition came out in the early 1980s, a revised edition, or at least two revised editions, have come out since. This little volume, a slim little volume, called Zachor, Jewish History and Jewish Memory, by Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi of Columbia University. He passed away just last year, Professor Yerushalmi, one of the great Jewish historians of this, of our generation. A very interesting character. Personally, I had the opportunity to meet him and to hear him on a couple of occasions when I lived in New York. He also wrote a pretty well received book on Freud's Judaism, on Freud's connection to his Judaism, called Freud's Moses, which is a very interesting book, a little bit out of the context of our discussion. So this little volume, which was a collection of four lectures that he gave on this topic of Jewish history and Jewish memory, he surveys what we call historiography, the writing of history. It's the history of history, as it were, thinking about how we think about history, how we write history. And he mentions the following: this astonishing assumption that an entire people can not only be admonished to remember, but held absolutely responsible for forgetting, is made as if, though, it were self-evident. The Torah mentions this idea that an entire nation, the entirety of the Jewish people, have to remember certain things, and we are collectively forbidden to forget anything. Yet surely collective forgetting is at least as problematic a notion as collective memory. If we take it in a psychological sense, it becomes virtually meaningless then. Strictly speaking, peoples, groups, can only forget the present, not the past. That is to say, the individuals who compromise the group can forget events that occurred within their own lifetime. They're incapable of forgetting the past that preceded them, in the sense that the individual human being forgets earlier stages of his own life history. When we say that a people remembers, quote unquote, we're really saying that a past has been actively transmitted to the present generation, and that this past has been accepted as meaningful. So to remember something is not so much as to preserve it from being forgotten, but it is to keep it front and center as a meaningful component of our lives. Conversely, a people forgets when the generation that now possesses the past does not convey it to the next, or when the latter rejects what it receives and does not pass it onward, which is to say the same thing. The break in transmission can occur abruptly or by a process of erosion, but the principle remains. A people can never forget what it has received in the first place. So that's a pretty interesting, somewhat radical reinterpretation of the biblical obligations of remembering and prohibition against forgetting, a notion that it has to do with the meaning that we assign to the meaning we assign to events. In earlier chapter, in the fourth, this that last section came, I think, from the postscript to the book. In the fourth chapter, the chapter that deals with what he calls modern dilemmas, he tells the following, and it is an interesting tale of how and when we assign meaning to the past and to history. Can everybody hear me? If you can hear me, please raise your hand. It seems some people are having trouble with the sound. Okay, it must be a localized event. Ezra, please try to help Joel if you can. So he points out the following: an anti-historical attitude of a very different kind is expressed by those who have experienced modern Jewish existence, as something so totally new that it demands the past be either forgotten or demolished, if you could imagine such a thing. The deep ambivalence of modern Jews to the past is perhaps best discerned in modern Hebrew literature, which even more than Yiddish or Anglo-Jewish letters reflects the widest spectrum of modern Jewish sensibility. A few times I've turned to my beloved Agnon in the course of our studies together, not looking to literature as a historical source, but looking to literature as the embodiment of historical ways of thinking. And And at a different point in the work, Yerushalmi makes this notion that an ignorance of Jewish literature is also problematic if one aspires to know Jewish history and the role that literature can and should and might play. The deep ambivalence of modern Jews to the past is perhaps best discerned in modern Jewish, best in modern Hebrew literature, which even more than Yiddish or Anglo-Jewish letters reflects the widest spectrum of modern Jewish sensibility. Here we find, on the one hand, the fiercest antagonism to the Jewish past, not as a personal idiosyncrasy, but a major theme that runs from the Haskalah to the present. One of the purest instances will suffice. Here's by way of example. In the explosive short story by the Hebrew writer Chaim Hazaz entitled Hadrasha, the sermon, a meeting of a kibbutz is held at which Yudka, who never speaks on such occasions, startles everyone by rising to unburden himself of thoughts he can no longer contain. There's this author, Chaim Hazaz. He's a very important 20th century Hebrew author. Born in the Ukraine, he comes to Israel, is one of the great authors here in Israel, largely unknown outside of Israel. There's a main street, an important street in Yerushalayim, named after him, at the intersects with Chernichovsky and Rehov Aza, not far from our office. Rehov Hazaz, Chaim Hazaz. This particular story, Hadrasha, appears in a volume called, where did I put it? Oh, here. There's a volume in English called The Sermon and Other Stories. It's a collection of his short stories by Chaim Hazaz, published by the Toby Press. Somebody can post it up. Hazaz lived from 1898 to 1973. So there's in this story called The Sermon, which is the title story in this collection of his collected stories in English. There's a meeting in the kibbutz, and this character, Yudke is a nickname, I guess, for Yehuda, who never speaks. He's a quiet person. The kibbutz is discussing the curriculum for the kibbutz school, and Yudke haltingly at first declares what's been gnawing at him. He stands up and he says, "I want to state," Yudke spoke with an effort in low, tense tones, "that I am opposed to Jewish history." And then, when his stammering gives way to an articulate fury, "I would simply forbid teaching our children Jewish history. Why the devil teach them about our ancestors' shame? I would just say to them, 'Boys, from the day we were exiled from our land, we've been a people without a history. Class dismissed. Go out and play football.'" Of course, football here is a translation of Kadur Regel. He meant what we call soccer, but that's a different point. There's this interesting idea, for an Israeli, for a Zionist, that the Jewish past is past, and we've turned a new page. No, it's not like Hillel's "Now go and study." "Now go and study" is an attempt to say, "I'm telling you what the essence of the Torah is, and you have to do the hard work of uncovering it and expanding it on your own." Here we're saying, it's a cute point, Chaim. Here we're saying it didn't happen. In other words, when Hillel says, "Zil gamur, go off and learn it on your own," that's after he's told him what the Kol HaTorah Kula is al regel achat, what the Torah is on one foot, as it were. But here, Yudke is saying, there was no Jewish history. From the day we were exiled from our land, from Tisha B'Av, right here we're coming up, a week before Tisha B'Av, from Tisha B'Av, we've been a people without a history. Blank slate. Now we've come back to Israel. The Zionists return to the land. We start again from scratch, as it were. And yet, concurrently, here Yerushalmi speaking again, modern Hebrew writers, you know what, I'm going to skip ahead. I'll skip ahead a bit. You can download, this is a quite a large section from the final chapter of the book. Here it is difficult. Here it is different. When I spoke earlier of the coincidence of the rise of modern Jewish historiography, the writing of Jewish history, and the decay of Jewish memory, I had in mind a specific kind of memory of the past, that of Jewish tradition. But hardly any Jew today is without some Jewish past. Total amnesis, lack of memory, is still relative. Total amnesia is still relatively rare. The choice for Jews, as for non-Jews, is not whether or not to have a past, but rather, what kind of past shall one have? So when we study Jewish history, there are choices we make. I mean, there are curricular choices. There are methodological choices. And the choices that we make are reflections of what kind of past do we want. I guess with a notion that the past that we choose for ourselves says something about the present we occupy and the future that we aspire to. Yudke, this character in the Chazaz story, who opposes Jewish history, has a past, only with an intermission of almost 2 millennia, of 2,000 years. It grinds to a halt with the fall of Masada in the 2nd century and resumes again with the return to Zion in the late 19th century. What happened in between is for him a nightmare best forgotten. I'm not sure Tzilele. I don't know that his name is a play. I mean, his name is a nickname for that wouldn't work in Hebrew. That play on words wouldn't work in Hebrew. Yutke is probably a nickname for Yehuda. It's true that Yehuda is connected to Shem Hashem, but I don't know that that's whether in this welter of floating pasts the voice of the historian is heard depends on many factors, but the question itself is not without consequence. For all of one's justified mistrust of historical parallelism, it is hard to escape the feeling that the Jewish people, after the Holocaust, stands today at a juncture not without analogy to that of the generations following the cataclysm of the Spanish expulsion. I think the second of the four chapters, one of the four chapters in the volume, is dedicated to the historiography of the Spanish expulsion, which was one of Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi was, his specialty was medieval Jewish history, even though he wrote about topics in modern Jewish life as well. But his real field was medieval Jewish history, and one of the chapters in this volume, Zachor, is about how the Spanish expulsion was remembered. The people that were remembering the Spanish expulsion, as we saw, ultimately chose myth over history, that there was this type of midrashic memory of what happened during the Inquisition and the expulsion, and not history as defined by modern or contemporary or academic or scholarly, the notion that history is meant to record the details as they actually happened, but history in the sense of casting in larger legendary tones the essence of what the experience was like. They, the Migurshei Sfarad, as we saw, ultimately chose myth over history, for reasons that it would be futile to question retroactively, since its consequences cannot be undone. Today, Jewry lives a bifurcated life as a result of emancipation in the diaspora and national sovereignty in Israel. Jews have fully re-entered the mainstream of history. That's a significant line, and it reflects a lot on what we've been studying. There are two very significant events. One is emancipation of Jews in the diaspora, the granting of citizenship, the granting of equal rights. The other is, quite differently, is the return of Jews to controlling their own lives in their own country. These two events, emancipation and Kom Hamdina, the establishment of the state, these two things are responsible for Jews fully re-entering the mainstream of history. What does he define the mainstream of history as? Jews in control of their own lives and not the subjects of other forces that they can't control or that for which they're not responsible. And yet their perception of how they got there and where they are is most often more mythical than real. Myth and memory condition action. There are myths that are life-sustaining and deserve to be reinterpreted for our age. There are some myths that lead astray and must be redefined. So the power of myth, the power of mythical memory, of remembering historical events in larger legendary tones, is very powerful. But there's a danger to it, and there's a power to it. Others are dangerous and must be exposed. I'll skip ahead again. The historian must fully confront a contemporary Jewish reality if he is to be heard at all. Yudka, for example, is very much part of that reality, and his demands are pressing. I understand Yudka very well, for in a sense, he is transparent. His repugnance for Jewish history in exile derives, in part, from a conception of it as nothing but the history of how Jews died and the books they wrote. It is a view that was, in the main, fostered by Wissenschaft historians themselves. That, of course, comes back to our discussion just last week, that this notion, the Wissenschaft, the academic study, the scientific study of Judaism as an offshoot of the Reform movement, as a kind of way to give Judaism a proper burial, to kind of get it down in an encyclopedic form, the history, because traditional Judaism, at least, wasn't going to exist in a generation or so, or so they thought. And that kind of just recording of the chronicle of Jewish history, of how Jews lived, how they died, books they wrote, that was a certain notion of what Judaism, what Jewish history was, and what role it played, and how it would serve encapsulating the culture, which was now going through cataclysmic transformation. And therefore, says Yerushalmi, I understand very well why Yudke, who represents a return to Jewish control over Jews' control of their own land, of their own life, is not interested in this 2,000-year blip, hiccup, as it were, in which those conditions of Jewish sovereignty were not active and were not real and were not in force. But he Yerushalmi points out that Jewish historiography has long outgrown this, the Wissenschaft notion, the notion of what Jewish history is that's so offensive to Yudke. But the historian who thinks that all Yudke requires is a knowledge easily assembled that there was a rich and abundant Jewish life in the Middle Ages, or proof that Jews were far from passive in the face of history, is mistaken. For the same stuttering Yudke who is opposed to history also has keen, if unsophisticated, historical instincts. For example, he at least knows viscerally that Zionism was a revolt against Jewish messianism. Jewish messianism in a sense of a passive waiting for the condition to be changed. This is not true about what we would call religious Zionism. We'll have to get to that in our next series. and that the national awakening and the return to the land are, in the words of that Hazaz gives him, no continuity but a break, the opposite of what was before, a new beginning. If Yudke represents a notion of a desire to erase memory, the story that Yerushalmi now tells brings the need to erase memory sharply into focus. He reminds us of, and again, it's a beautiful example of literature here, not even Jewish literature, encapsulating something very insightful about history. I just put a link in the chat, this link here, to a story. I'm pretty sure that the link takes you to this short story by Jorge Luis Borges. Borges was this was a very, very significant, one of the greatest modern authors of the 20th century, wrote in Spanish, born in Argentina. He lived in Europe at some point in his life. Great novelist, great short story author. Borges has this short story called Funes de Memorias, is how it's translated into English. This link that I just put up, this tiny URL link, is, I think it's the whole version of the short story. It could be that it's a slightly abridged version of the short story, but if you go there, you can see it. So Borges tells a story, Funes el Memorioso, Funes the Memorious. Memorious, I think that's probably a word that the translator made up in English to match this Spanish term, but it's Funes, the one who remembers everything. Funes is his name, the name of the character, which haunts me largely because, though Borges did not intend it so, he called it a metaphor of insomnia, it looms as a possibly demonic parable for a potential denouement to modern historiography as a whole. It is a tale about a Uruguayan, Erinio Funes, who, as the result of a fall from a horse at the age of 19, found that henceforth he could forget nothing, absolutely nothing. It's the opposite of amnesia, right? Amnesia, you can't remember, you don't remember anything. Funes suffers the opposite condition, where he can't forget anything. Now, it's possible, there are actually conditions. There are a few very rare cases in the annals of psychology and neurology where people suffer something like this. And it's possible that Borges modeled his story on an actual case which was documented by Alexander Luria. Luria himself, of course, was Jewish, great 20th century pioneer of psychology in Russia. And he has this little book, which I once read. It's a fascinating book. Yerushalmi makes mention of it elsewhere here, called The Mind of the Mnemonist. Mnemonism, right, like mnemonic device. A mnemonic device is a trick that you use to remember something. So the mind of a mnemonist is a mind of a rememberer. A little book about a vast memory. You can get it on, translated from Russian into English. It's a case study. If you've read any Oliver Sacks, any of Oliver Sacks's great books, you know, these little case studies of interesting cases in neurology and psychology. Oliver Sacks often makes reference to Luria. And in a few places, I think he even makes reference to this particular work. It's a case study of a patient who's known by the initial S. If you go on to Wikipedia, if you follow the links to Luria and this book on Wikipedia, you'll find background information on the case. And similar to Funes, this S has this incredibly massive memory. S himself is Jewish. That comes out in the case study. There's a suggestion, actually, even that his study of language, his study of Hebrew, played into it. I don't recall the specific details, but if you find the book, you can probably come across it. I imagine that in any well-stocked library, even you can get Luria's book. So it could be that this Funes is based, this fictional character is based on actual case studies, although it's a very rare condition. I mean, I think amnesia is a pretty rare condition. I mean, you know, if you watch soap operas, I guess it happens all the time, but that's, you know, for the necessities of plot devices. But real amnesia, where you forget everything, you wake up in the hospital and you don't know who you are or where you got there, that's exceedingly rare. Short-term amnesia actually happens. I actually had a friend once who slipped on the ice and hit her head, and she had amnesia in the sense that there was 48 hours that she lost, but she remembered who she was and where she was from and etc. But the 48 hours or so before the fall were completely blacked out, and she never recovered those memories of those 2 days. But this case, the mirror image of amnesia, the mnemonism, where you remember everything, that's pretty rare. So Funes can forget nothing. He tells Borges himself is the narrator of the story, so the character tells Borges, "I have more memories in myself alone than all men have had since the world was a world." But I give you now Borges' own words. See, now he quotes from the story. "We at a glance perceive three wine glasses on the table. Funes saw all the shoots, clusters, and grapes of the vine. He remembered the shapes of the clouds in the south at dawn on the 30th of April in 1882, and he could compare them, in his recollection, with the marbled grain in the design of a leather-bound book he had seen only once, and with the lines of the spray which an oar raised in the Rio Negro in the river on the eve of the Battle of Quebracho," whatever that may be. "In effect, Funes remembered not only every leaf on every tree and every wood, but every one of the times he had perceived or imagined it. He remembered everything he'd ever seen, and he remembered thinking about, and he remembered everything he'd ever, and he remembered every time he thought about everything he'd ever seen. He determined to reduce all of his experiences to some 70,000 recollections, which he would later define numerically. Two considerations dissuaded him: the thought that the task was interminable, and the thought that it was useless. He knew that at the hour of his death he would scarcely have finished classifying even all the memories of his childhood." Now, Yerushalmi continues, "The shadow of Funes the Memorious hovers over all of us. Today, increasingly, historiography itself becomes the object of historical inquiry." In other words, we study history, and then we study the history of history, and then we'll study the history of the history of history. And when we attempt to study, part of what we have to do is make choices, and we have to remember what it is that we must forget, because memory and forgetting are connected. If you remember everything, then nothing has meaning. So this balance between the imperative to remember and the fear of forgetting are very much connected. And the decisions that we make about remembering and forgetting. Remember, again, Yerushalmi had suggested that when we talk about memory and forgetting on a national level, it's a question not of memory and forgetting, like, I forgot to buy milk on the way home today, or I remembered that it was my son's birthday, but a question of meaning-making. When we say that a people remembers, we are really saying that a past has been actively transmitted to the present generation, and that this past has been accepted as meaningful, he had said earlier. So, in order to assign meaning, we have to make a triage of values. So the study of history is the way that we put those values into in the way that we make them come alive in the real world, and how we study and what we study and what methods we choose and what we emphasize and the lessons that we try to extrapolate from history, these are the embodiments of our notions of meaning. And the necessity of forgetting, of assigning secondary or tertiary or non-meaning to something is also an expression of those values. Otherwise, you become funis and you go mad with the notion that we remember everything. Because if everything is of primary importance, that's also a way of saying, really, that nothing is. So this kind of, values assignment is essential in the study of history. Now, this doesn't mean he also elsewhere makes, I mean, in this section that I didn't read, he makes this point that, on one level, the study of history and, it's the search for the last footnote, of getting everything, of trying to get it all down. But that's the grunt work of history. The hard work of history, the educational work of history, is to try to discover the meaning between memory and history, between meaning and history, and to try to think about it. So we've studied quite a bit together. Nobody approaches the study of anything, let alone the study of history, without filtering it through their own value system. I mean, I guess that's the work of being a teacher. I think some of the things that we've talked about, how Jewish life, how our commitment to Jewish culture, how our commitment to halacha, how trying to navigate those things in the complexities of the modern world. By modern world, I don't mean 2010. Modern world, I'm talking about the early 19th century. But the condition of entering modernity with all of its assumptions, these are really very tricky things. And it's pretty remarkable, of course, that we're all here today. Not just because there were so many b'chol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chalotenu. There were so many attempts to get rid of us. That, of course, is remarkable and something for which we're grateful. But it's equally remarkable that we didn't manage to destroy ourselves. I often think that, even today, sometimes we're our own worst enemy. And that's a remarkable thing about Jewish history, if you stop to think about it. These are some thoughts. Some of Yerushalmi's conclusions, of course, we wouldn't accept, but I think his laying out of these notions are useful to helping us think about our own encounter with the study of Jewish history. And it's worthwhile reading his short book Zachor, Jewish History, and Jewish Memory. We will continue, please God. In a few months' time, after the Chagim, we'll pick up again, and we'll continue the march of Jewish history, looking east, then looking back west, and hopefully we'll get to a discussion about the rise of Zionism, the establishment of the state, some other things. So there are a few links. I want to thank you all, of course, for being with us for the series. I want to thank Alan for serving as the unofficial teacher's assistant, posting those links into the chat for me. If you're inclined to buy books, which is always a good thing, so then get some of these. I remind you that I think it's a good idea to buy some of these books used. On Amazon, you can get great deals by buying used books. In most cases, they're really in pretty good condition. I've never been disappointed. Or again, if you have an access to a good library, even sometimes a good shul library, a good synagogue library, or even a good, certainly a good academic library. A lot of books you can get in the library, and I would recommend some of them. You know, as always, feel free to be in touch with me by email or by Google chat or by Skype. My Google chat and Skype name is just Jeffrey Sachs, all one word. And we will continue in Elul with other Torah study, and after the Chagim with Jewish history and some other courses. And those of you that are in the Thursday night Rambam class, I will see you then. And if not, have a meaningful Tisha B'Av and a good summer, and stay in touch.